Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Jim Isaac, president of the IEEE CS, renowned innovator, leader, researcher, and educator. Jim, you bring a substantive history of significant and considerable international contribution to engineering, computing science, innovation, research, education, society, and industry to this interview. We are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen, for inviting me.
Jim, it was a real pleasure to talk with you at the World Computing Congress in Brisbane, Australia in September. Congratulations on your remarkable contributions as president of the IEEE CS.
It's been an exciting year. It's a one-year term for the president, and I've had a chance to get to Australia, as you mentioned, but then also visit other parts of the world and many of our professionals around the world as well.
You know, Jim, we have a number of people within our audience of varying ages, and sometimes they're really sort of driven by the passion of remarkable leaders like yourself who have this amazing career and are world-renowned. So perhaps you can share what triggered your initial interest in technology and then what forces shaped your interests.
Well, certainly one major factor was my father, who was an electrical engineer. I recall at one point even working with him building a Tesla coil in our garage and learning about how those things worked, although I must admit when I got to college I ran into a fellow named David Grease, who's our dorm advisor and also has become subsequently a very well-renowned computer scientist and professor. And he encouraged me to take a class in Algol programming, and at that point I got hooked on programming. It just became a really fun thing to do. So people like him and Ed Feigenbaum, Pat Soupies, Don Knuth were all people I had as professors, and an opportunity to really get some of the top people in the field to give me ideas about how they approach the world and how I might do so.
You know, when I sort of scan your career, and I just see these amazing contributions made over a great period of time. And well, if perhaps you can then maybe provide your career highlights and then maybe valuable lessons that you would to share with the audience.
Well, early, in fact, even when I was in college, it was just as the idea of a computer that you could have up your house became viable, and at that point there were mini computers. I actually contacted a bunch of mini computer vendors and said, gee, what would it cost to get one of these things? A little out of my price range at the time, but I followed sort of that line of thinking. My first published article was actually on personal computing networks, something that later got replaced by real PCs with the World Wide Web, but it was an interesting thing to contemplate and to write about. I even simulated a system like that when I was working at IBM as a student. The thing that I think I've learned from a lot of that, and I just might point out that in that process, I followed that sort of idea going with going with microprocessor manufacturers as my primary employers for much of my life, people like Intel, Data General, Digital Equipment, and so forth. What I learned as a result was you really have to, when you see something that inspires you, just go for it. And it will take you places that nobody is looking, because if you're being a bit inspired, you're going to end up going places that nobody else has gone before. And that's really a lot of fun and quite rewarding.
So can you now profile the IEEE CS and what you wanted to accomplish as president?
Well, the Computer Society is one of the major computing societies in the world. We have people all the way around the world, 200 and some odd countries. We run 300 conferences a year. We have 30 or so publications, ranging from very highly valued academic publications to magazines targeted at practitioners. So it's a very widespread professional society. The main things that inspired me to get involved and the things I wanted to accomplish involved how to build the environment into the 21st century to support professionals. So my first priority in that respect has been to look at how we do online communities so that people in the computing profession can interact. There are a number of places you could go online to do this, but most of them involve the general public, involve anonymous interactions. You don't necessarily operate under your own name. And as a professional society, we're actually a slightly more limited community looking at how we can interact with each other professionally, by name, recognizing each other's contributions and interactions. So that was my first priority, to get an online community facility operational within the society. The other thing has been to communicate about the role that the professional society plays for individuals. I think people don't fully appreciate the impact that it has operating and collaborating with other professionals, even in what you might call a marginally professional environment. Clearly, when you're working with somebody else in the same field, solving a problem either at the university or at the an industry, you have a lot of interaction that's highly technical and very focused. But when you get into a professional society, you start working on things, maybe standards or editing publications, conference papers, conference committees. You meet other people. You start talking about things less formally. And that actually inspires a lot of innovation. A lot of good ideas come out of the non-directed thinking that takes place in those interactions, what's called social capital development. We'll probably get to that later, but trying to get people to become aware of that and realize that being involved helps their career build innovation. I should mention, when I say career, I've changed careers 9 times in the history of my employment. And, well, I should say I changed careers 3 times. That's major changes from what I did before, and changed jobs about 9 times. Almost every one of those is triggered by interactions in the professional environment through either IEEE, the Computer Society, sometimes people in my previous employers that called me up and say, hey, Jim, got a neat idea. Do you want to join us in doing this? So a variety of things that did that, but without those society connections, that my career just wouldn't have gone the same places.
What is the impact on computing on the future, and what is the challenge?
Well, the big issue, of course, is computers are now everywhere. So we have them impacting our activities from even the devices involved in this telephone conference or obviously the personal computing devices all the way up to mainframe and supercomputers. The impact that is there for society is huge, too, if these things fail. And I was at a pizza parlor recently, and the point-of-sale systems failed, and they were not able to actually take orders and deliver orders because their little devices that they're taking money in wouldn't work. Needless to say, that frustrates everybody. And when that happens on a larger scale or in an area where it's a matter of safety or the economy, it creates great concerns. And we as computing professionals need to understand that and take a lot more professional attention to what we do so that people don't get frustrated and we can keep to keep the world operating smoothly. Along with that is a major challenge in the area of security and privacy. Because they're ubiquitous, computers now have the ability to keep an eye on what we're doing in ways that we have never imagined. And that can be disturbing. We need to make sure that people understand what they can do and that policymakers and the public are sufficiently informed that they can actually make informed choices as to whether they want to share data or allow certain technologies to become prevalent in certain areas. Certainly, just the idea that people can have cameras now anywhere, I think people start to realize that may not always be a good idea. Unfortunately, a lot of young people don't fully realize that the things they're doing online may very well have a permanent record. So, again, people not necessarily being aware of how the technology might be recording what they're doing and available later, affecting future job opportunities, future relationships. The social impact of what we're doing is very large. If you look out far enough, the industry is also having a huge impact on the environment. The idea that we can throw cell phones away or that our computers are expendable is a disturbing thought because, first of all, we have an industry dependent on it. So we have computer manufacturers who feel they need to make more and more units. And of course, if you're going to sell more and more units, that means you're going to replace the units that are already there, and those are going to fill landfills. And that's not particularly good business. That's not it may be a good business model, but it's not sustainable for the environment. So we need to think through how do we maintain a viable computer industry. At the same time, we have long-term, long lifespan devices with very low carbon footprints, something that will be a major issue for us in the future, I think, as our technology, again, just becomes pervasive everywhere we go.
You know, when I look over your career, you know, at Digital Equipment, Charles River Data Systems, Data General, Intel, your teaching positions, the many awards that you won, your POSEX work is just really quite amazing and remarkable. So I think you're sort of the perfect individual to ask this next question about how do we enable innovation?
Well, innovation starts with ideas. That's sort of obvious, but you have to give people the opportunity to both come up with the ideas, an environment where they can do that, and then you have to encourage them to express them. And then the third one is the ability to follow up. So I point to what I had said earlier on professional societies. From a standpoint of the individual, get out and be in contact with people that are not in your cubicle. The people that you have at the office are the people already thinking the same way you are, for whatever reason. That's why you're in that organization. When you get out and start interacting with other people, maybe in the field and maybe not in the field, you start to be exposed to ideas and ways of approaching things that are different, and that's where the new ideas come from, is the cross-connection between different disciplines and different perspectives. And internationally, that same thing is true. If you're Chinese, you start interacting with somebody who's Indian or somebody from the United States, and if you're European, just the other way around. You need to listen to and understand how people are coming at problems and perspectives that are just different. Once you have the idea, you have to figure out, you know, who cares? Your employer may or may not actually be interested in it or concerned with it. One of my biggest frustrations, you mentioned the variety of companies I work for, Digital Equipment, very large company. At the time I worked for them, the largest company I'd ever worked for, and they had lots of really brilliant ideas. They brought some of them out, things like AltaVista, which was the first search engine. But they didn't know how to turn it into a product. They didn't become Google because basically they didn't see the opportunity that Google saw in how a search engine might actually, you know, what the business model was for that or how it might actually benefit people. So you need that third thing, which is the way in which you can actually translate it into a product that can make money so that people can really benefit from the results. Innovation really has all three of those. How do you spark the ideas? How do you provide an environment where they can actually be valued and built upon? And then how do you translate them into long-term impact for society?
You know, we sort of touched on this before, and that is you talked about social capital. And I know you have a passion for social capital. So what does this mean, and can you profile the research in this area?
Social capital is a fairly new term applied to a fairly old concept. Basically, at its heart, is when people get together and start interacting with each other, they build relationships, they learn to trust each other, and they start to understand what they can do together. So one simple phrasing for that is what's historically called the old boys club. The people who know each other get together and make things happen. The bad news is that sometimes that's true. It is old and it is boys, but it isn't necessarily that way. And I think any of the young people today can see that there are a lot of connections they make and a lot of relationships they build. The trick is to not lose those, to keep maintaining those over time. And think about if you have a problem, who do you go to solve that? It's somebody you know, typically. If I have a problem with my PC, I'll call up a friend who's worked with those type of systems and say, hey, how does this work? How can I fix it? What should I do for the next generation? Where should I go buy one of these things? That's all part of that social capital environment. Relationships you build, turning into, that is to say, a social aspect, turning into value added in terms of it can be just personal, where do I get a new computer? Or it may have a huge impact when you call up somebody like your friend down the street and say, you know, maybe we ought to start a search engine company. Have you ever thought of that? Or maybe we ought to build one of these new devices that's a handheld, whatever. And sometimes that isn't in technology you're related to at all. But social capital can spin right off into other areas. My relationships at IEEE have led to involvement in various education projects with students or science fair judging or helping out kids in robotics teams. So it spans all sorts of directions just because of the people you know and learning that that's the key to where the ideas come from and where the opportunities come from to make things better. The research here is interesting because I noticed this when I was working on the POSEX standards activities, is that people were putting a lot of attention and interest into standards, which did not actually result in their getting paid, to the point that they actually leave an employer at times to continue working in the standard. So I sort of watched that behavior, and I actually did it once. I changed from Charles River Data Systems to digital equipment because I felt I needed to dedicate myself to the standards activity more than my employer, which is an interesting observation if you think about it. So people are making these transitions. I said, well, why do they do that? You know, what I learned as a part of my research when I got in the academic world is the social capital thing, which is documented by probably most publicly by Robert Putnam in a book called Bowling Alone, is a very deep-rooted concept. There is research going back literally to the 16th, 1700s on how it impacts things like corporate livelihood. Early research indicated that corporations, accounting firms in Amsterdam, actually had a longer lifespan as a corporation if they had established good social capital than if they hadn't. And that was measured by how many business relationships they had recorded in the various professional societies of the time, which is an interesting history. More recently, there's good indication that it correlates with innovation, with the ability of individuals and corporations generating patents and generating new ideas, new products. So it spans deep history in terms of time and very wide impact in terms of how it can be of value to individuals and the organizations they work with.
You know, you're talking about social capital, and I can see that there needs to be hubs of ecosystems to sort of spawn and sort of act as a, I don't know, as an incubator for social capital. And then it sort of goes to the IEEE CS itself. Now, how does involvement with the IEEE CS support social capital? How does the IEEE CS act as a hub of this ecosystem for social capital?
We don't state it clearly, and it's sort of the underwritten idea of a professional society, that you're there for, and then you say, okay, why are we involved? And this really is not unique to the IEEE or the Computer Society, but we're there sort of to keep on top of the profession. What are the technologies, what's happening, what's the academic research saying? So we're there to read papers or maybe create papers and publish them. We're there for the conferences, but if you look at the conference, and Vince Cerf said this in a video I saw recently, basically said, it's not what happens in the conference room, it's what happens in the hallway. And that is a very important thing to realize, that we go not just for the dialogue, the published paper, but to meet the people and to interact with them. And that's really where professional societies come into play. They give you the environment where you can actually meet people, start to interact with them, and then let that grow. So I certainly encourage people to join the Computer Society, for one thing, but any professional society can give you this, as long as it's related to your field and you can establish the connections with the people that are there.
I guess that means that there's this organization called the International Federation for Information Processing, and they have national societies throughout the world, and a person in Asia, for example, could join their local national society or Latin America. And though I guess the IEEE is global in terms of your reach, so in that way there's maybe one advantage in joining the IEEE CS. But there are local national societies.
There are, and each brings its own value to the table. A lot of what happens in terms of opportunity for both career development but also impact occurs locally. And so that local society can be of high value in terms of connecting with other people in the area, with other employers, with other professionals, and solving problems that are maybe unique to that area. The global connection, IFIP, IEEE, organizations like that, allow you to then cross-connect that with professionals elsewhere. And they may have the solution you need locally, or they may be able to bring resources to bear, or they may have a need to bring you over to where they are to help solve a problem where they are. So it's each of those levels of connectivity expands your individual view of what can happen and your opportunities to make it happen.
You know, again, when I talk about or I think about the IEEE CS, you know, you are global in nature. You cross boundaries. You have a lot of diversity because you're in different parts of the world, and you are, I guess, the largest professional society for IT professionals. So what is really meant then by cross-boundary spanning and dimension-side diversity, and perhaps you can use examples within the IEEE CS?
You know, the term cross-boundary spanning is actually a term of art in the study of social capital, but it has huge impact. You cross boundaries, and you can to be minor boundaries or major boundaries. Within your own organization, if you're in engineering and you step over and start talking to people in marketing, you've just crossed a boundary. And the better you understand them, they understand you, that can have a huge benefit to your organization. You get into an organization like IEEE, where we have people who are information technology, we have people who do power systems, we have people who do consumer electronics, and all of a sudden you're in a room with people that where the boundaries are significant. If you look at a problem like smart grid, where we're trying to figure out how to use technology, information technology, to improve power delivery, to improve the efficiency and the economics of power and the lower the impact of power generation and energy generation, you need all those skills in the room. You learn from the people who do battery systems, what can they contribute? You know, how do we store local energy? Meet with the people who look at the power grid and how power transmission occurs, and well, how do we, is it AC or is it DC, what information would be useful to actually allow that to be more effective. Then you get into the household consumer electronics. Well, what do we put in devices at the household in order to be able to keep track of what the power requirements will be? Notice we want to know what they're going to be tomorrow or even in 3 minutes or 2 hours so we can deliver the power that's needed to that house without wasting any. Ideally, you'd only put out power from the generating sources to match exactly the need that's out there and not waste any. Those are non-trivial problems, but it quite requires people to span the boundaries and cross over between those areas and talk to the other people. So that's the boundary spanning side. And diversity, one aspect of diversity is clearly that, the people who bring that different degree into the room and the different perspective from that. But another degree of diversity that's very important in this is also the cultural diversity that you get. I've had discussions between even the United States and Canada, and there's just enough cultural difference between those two environments that when we start talking about, well, how do we deliver power across the international boundaries, what information flows, and so forth, you start realizing, it makes a difference whether the power comes from the James River Valley in the northern part of Canada or whether it's coming from the Mississippi River Valley down in the United States. And, of course, when you span even larger boundaries, like how do we manage smart grids through China and India, Asia, you start to realize that the cultural diversity is something that needs to be taken into account and can bring a huge value to the table because people will see things differently and have a different way of approaching it and get to different solutions, some of which are going to be better than others.
It sort of leads to this next idea then, and how would you define boundary-spanning stars?
And this is really the opportunity for the individual. So hopefully people out there listening to this will start to see themselves in this role. Once you start spanning a boundary, whether it's in your own organization or it's outside, so if you become the person who understands how your information technology opportunities relate to the power grid, for example, you become what people refer to as the go-to person that you have the question in this area, go talk to them. You essentially become a star. You don't become a star because somebody said, oh, we want you to become the expert. They might. You become a star because you actually do become the expert. And you become that by simply crossing the boundary and establishing knowledge in multiple areas so that when you are in either environment, they look at you and say, oh, we're in the power environment. You know about IT. How do we use this? How can we get that information? What kind of tools are available? Flip that around into the IT side, you're in the IT environment. You understand the power grid. What information is there? How can we get that information? How can we make sure that gets used effectively? What systems do we have to build to manage it? So the stars are effectively self-selecting people. I've seen this historically in the Unix and POSIX standards activities. The people who did that in their corporations very quickly became the knowledgeable experts on the standards, on what customers wanted because they were talking to customers and they knew what the customers wanted, on what the vendors were doing, what the competitors were doing. They acquired that knowledge from just being in the standards activities and interacting with these group of people, this diversity of people in that environment. And the same kind of thing can happen in any collaboration. Go to a conference, and if you take the time to meet people and sit down at the lunch table and talk about things, you start acquiring that unique perspective that comes from the different views that you put on the table, and you can take that back into your company, and literally you become a star. That's how you get there.
I'm just smiling here because, Jim, when I think about what you've done and what you continue to do, you're a boundary-spanning superstar. So what are the major challenges facing the IEEE CS today, and how will you and the IEEE CS work to solve them?
The number one problem is bringing new people into the field and into our societies, obviously. There are places in the world, China and India being classic, where engineering and information technology are understood and highly valued at very high levels in the policy-making world. The organizations are willing to make investments in them, and in the general public. Essentially, if you're in one of these countries and your son wants to be an engineer, your daughter wants to be an information technologist, people say, yes, go do it. It's great. A lot of encouragement to go that way. The rest of the world, unfortunately, and that's literally North America, Asia, not Asia, but North America and Europe, maybe a bit in Japan, are seeing a movement away from that. The people aren't going towards those technology careers, and that's a very disturbing thought for the economies of those countries, because that's where a lot of the growth is going to occur. And needless to say, a challenge for the professional societies. So one of our objectives, and actively in the Computer Society, is to encourage people to go into the field across the world. We're very pleased to see China growing. We're very pleased to see India growing. We'd love to see Europe growing more. We'd love to see the United States growing more, and Canada and South America, because those are all places where people will have the ideas, the innovation will occur, and that's going to solve the next generation of problems for the world. So that's one challenge we have. Another one we have is just simply the impact our own technology is having on our operations. 20 years ago, the only way of delivering professional society information to people was on paper. You publish magazines, you publish papers. We build a whole mechanism for collecting these things, doing peer review, putting them into logical units called magazines, and shipping them back out to people. Well, you still want the quality review, but we're doing it all online now. The professional is looking online to get answers, to find out what the most recent research is. It's no longer packaged up in magazines, or at least it doesn't logically have to be packaged up in magazines. And we still need the peer review to make sure that the stuff that's being put together is of high quality. It reflects a good understanding of the field. So we need to figure out new ways of literally organizing this information flow so that it happens quickly, it happens with high quality, and it happens in a way that the professional society can sustain itself, because any of the professional societies today are dependent on the income from subscriptions, from memberships, from conferences, and as the business models change behind that, it puts at risk the organizations that are trying to maintain that and deliver it. So it's a complex problem as affecting us as it does every other area that's being impacted by information technology.
I guess there's the counter to this. You know, we talked about some of the challenges facing the IEEE CS today, and what are then the major opportunities facing the IEEE CS, and how will the IEEE CS work to leverage them?
It's absolutely the other side of the same coin. How do we use online technology? How do we use information technology to deliver what people really need and want at the time they need it? One of the phrases we came up with a couple of years ago in the development of a standard I was working on was the right information for the right person at the right time. The amount of technical material, just in IEEE alone, we've gone from a situation in the year 2000 where we had somewhere around 200,000 to 400,000 articles online in our digital library, to the year 2010, where we have 200,000 articles a year entering our digital library. So it's not only doubled, substantially more than doubled in size, but the rate of increase is amazing, and no professional can stay on top of that. It's just impossible, and that it's only going to get worse. So what we mean is we need to take each little piece of information that comes out in the form of a professional article or academic research piece and identify how to make sure that gets the people who need to know it. And only the people who know it, there's no need for exclusivity here, but specifically get it to them individually. So 5-10 years from now, you'll want to, be, as a professional, go in and say, what's happening? And you'll see a set of information about articles, conferences, online events, webinars, whatever, that's very focused on your interests and needs. And anything more than that, you're just going to be overwhelmed. We're on the verge of being overwhelmed already. But the avalanche is going to continue. So the challenge and the opportunity is to find a way to get the information just for the individual that they need, so they're not looking through tens of thousands of articles or pieces of information in order to find the piece they need.
You know, something really struck me. I just returned from a multi-week tour of China at the invitation of their government and spoke at global summits, ending up with a multinational summit of corporations, Fortune 500 corporations, and also met with the organizers of the first global world CIO forum. And I was just sort of struck by the amazing sort of growth and development. In fact, during one of my speeches, I actually mentioned that China now has the fastest supercomputer, and that announcement came like 2 days before my speech. And I just saw an announcement from a conference board, I think out of New York, saying that China will overcome the U.S. and GDP, that's a PPP GDP, in 2012. And you see this sort of tremendous investment and development occurring, and I hear this other news release saying that they'll overtake the U.S. in patents next year. And then last week I was speaking to the head of advisory for IT for Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and also the head of advisory for India. And in fact, he's the chief operating officer for KPMG in India. And he's saying that they're growing at something like 50% per year. What is all of that tremendous kind of energy that's happening in Asia? What does that mean to the IEEE ECS? And is that an opportunity or is that a challenge? What does that represent?
Well, very parallel to that, we've had our first Chinese-initiated standard actually approved, I think, this week, and four or five more coming into the queue. So just as you're seeing these areas of growth occurring in the economics, occurring in the just simple performance of computers, you're also seeing China and India become very active players in terms of standardization, professional paper generation, conferences. I actually just opened an office in India about 3 weeks ago. We've had one in China now for about a year. And we actually, I think, have some Chinese language publications, or at least translated publications into Chinese. India, of course, operates primarily in English, so that makes life a little easier. But absolutely, a lot of the innovation is going to occur in China and India. It already is occurring in China and India. And the challenge for professional societies in these fields is to help people understand that, see it, share it, know what's going on across the boundaries so everybody can take advantage of it. The Chinese have been very effective users of online digital libraries to do the research to get the information. I'm sure that's building their patent portfolios, and the rest of the world's going to want to look at what's going on in China and be able to do the same thing in reverse. China may stay at the lead just simply because they have more people doing it. And you know, somebody once pointed out when you have a million people or 100 million people doing something, a fair number of those, equal numbers in every country, are going to be above average. Some are going to be geniuses. There are going to be more geniuses in China doing this work just because of more people in China doing the work. What worries me is not so much that we have a lot of people in China who are geniuses doing great things, but that in European countries and North American countries, we don't have as many people going that direction. And if the real opportunities to impact humanity, to really improve the world, are in science and technology, and I certainly believe they are. And if we don't have those people in North America and in Europe, we're going to lose our opportunity and we're going to lose the brain power of those countries to help solve the problems of the world.
So do you consider then the IEEE ECS, it really has its roots in North America and in fact in the U.S., but it's really a global organization. So do you sort of foresee maybe within the next 5 or 10 years, the president being out of Asia rather than, from a Western country?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. We've had presidents already whose native tongue is Mandarin or their native tongue is one of the Hindi variations. They happened to be living in the U.S. when they became president of the Computer Society, but certainly not a... We've already sort of been there. I wouldn't at all be surprised to see presidents in the future come out of India, China, other parts of the world. It's just a matter of connectivity. Our challenge is to make sure we find the best people in those countries and involve them so that they both want to take on those roles and that we know who they are, because for better or worse, social capital plays into who gets selected for candidates for various offices, and if people aren't known, they don't get selected. So we just need to make sure we draw those people in and have them learn about us and we learn about them.
So what are some of the IEEE CS success stories?
Well, the obvious success story that is a primary distinction is in standards. The Computer Society and IEEE have literally been taking the lead in a whole areas of standards. The 802 series of Ethernet and wireless and personal area networking and Wi-Fi, WiMAX, all IEEE standards. So that's been a big win. And the same thing propagates through the power industry, where the IEEE is the primary supplier of standards for the power industry and for other fields. My own work in standards has been in operating systems, Unix and Linux now, standards. And we need to do more there. There's a whole new generation of standards coming out that we need in terms of best practices for online publishing, for example. As the mobile devices proliferate, every vendor wants to create a unique environment from a publisher standpoint, IEEE as a publisher as well. We would like to see some standards that we could target so that our results can be presented on any device, whether it's a Kindle or Apple iPad or whatever. And so we need to encourage standardization there. Certainly, IEEE and the Computer Society have been major publishers of academic articles, and that's been a historical mainstay for professional societies, for scientific professional organizations. The other thing that we've done with great success is, I think, particularly in the Computer Society, has been engaging practitioners, people who are out there in the field actually doing the work. It's parallel to some of the activity we do in standards. Standards aren't very academic. They're very practical. Become important when people actually go out and use them. You know, this is the way you make the wiring. This is the protocol you use on this cable. This is the format we can use to exchange data in this area. There's a bit of academic research behind some of those things, but a lot of it's just practitioner, how do we make this work for users? And that's where I think the Computer Society has been particularly effective, at helping bridge the gap between the academic research, what could be done, what the ideas are, what proves out in the laboratory, and turn that into or help people use that to solve problems in the field and get the practicing engineer and the practicing technologist the information they need so they can actually put it into a product and deliver it.
We've already touched upon this, I guess, throughout the interview in terms of your discussion about social capital, about some of the areas that the IEEE CS is involved with, and then also in terms of success stories and standards. And I guess if you can summarize it now, what is the value of being involved in professional societies?
We've mentioned two, one of which is the innovation opportunities, the exposure that gives you the ideas and lets you tap into ideas. And the second one is the social capital, knowing who you can go to, knowing, you know, building your career around your field, contacts you have in your field. The other things that are also very important that come out of professional societies are soft skills that are essential to long-term business success. I've talked to people at IBM and Northrop Grumman and other major corporations, and they talk about what is the career model, what do they see a professional look like? And I've heard the term a T model being used. A T model has that vertical bar representing the depth of an individual's experience in a certain area. So you may be an experienced, a very deeply experienced person in some form of design or software development or graphics activities or even, you know, game development. But the vertical bar, or I should say the horizontal bar, is the one that reflects your soft skills. Do you know how to work in a team? Can you communicate with others? What is your leadership experience? What's your collaboration style? And those are things that you can develop in a professional society. Employers don't pay a lot of attention to building those skills. Some do, but basically they don't. And universities typically don't either. More and more you'll see universities with team-oriented projects, major presentations required as a part of a project, things like that. But when you get into a professional society, you're in a team. team already. You know, whether you're in a peer review group, whether you're in a committee organizing a conference, whether you're in a local committee, just planning who the speaker is going to be at your next local chapter meeting, you're starting to work in terms of team activities. The activities you're working in are almost always communication-based. How do we exchange ideas? Who can do a good job of communicating this? And you build leadership. You sit around for a while, and pretty soon somebody says, well, gee, you know, can you take on the chairman of this, or can you help coordinate this activity or whatever? So you're building these skills in a place where it doesn't put your career at risk, and it doesn't put your employer at risk. You know, very unlikely to come into a corporation and have somebody say, oh, you have a major project here. Would you mind taking responsibility for it? Not going to happen day one. So they're going to put you down in some place and say, oh, you know, welcome to the team, and after you prove yourself, we may give you some more responsibility and autonomy. IEEE in professional societies, you can get responsibility, autonomy, leadership opportunities very quickly, and we won't always succeed. We know that. But our risks are much lower. We're not going to end up, you know, we may not have as good a conference as we would have had otherwise. We might not have as the speaker arrangements may not work quite right. But you learn from those things, and then all of a sudden you start acquiring the skills. So now you say, oh, next time we'll do this and this and this. And then you learn to work with other people better. So being involved in professional societies builds a whole set of skills that aren't well developed and don't have the opportunity to be developed elsewhere.
Now, if you can choose the areas, can you provide some top predictions of future trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, certainly one big trend is going to be towards high-performance, data-intensive computing, and it's going to permeate what we do. The problem I alluded to earlier of having hundreds of thousands of articles being published in the professional world and the need to find just those you need or value or at the time you want them is going to be everywhere. We're going to find entertainment content that's going to explode. We're going to find information about individuals that explodes in terms of what's available. And we need to build the tools, and it's right back to our professions to do it, that can help us manage that information explosion so people can find what they need when they want it. So that's going to be a big deal. It probably involves artificial intelligence. It's rather humorous. I look back when I was in college, things like simply sorting algorithms were on the edge of artificial intelligence. People didn't fully understand how to do them, and we look back today, and well, that's technology. And what I realize is that artificial intelligence is sort of what we call what we haven't yet solved yet in terms of complex problem solving. And once we solve it, it just becomes technology. Well, everybody knows how to do that. But we need artificial intelligence type thinking, complex problem solving, to help sort out just the deluge of information that's going to come at us. One other trend, which I guess I'll join Ray Kurzweil and others in anticipating, that one of these days computers are going to wake up. And it's a controversial assertion, but consciousness or intelligence will emerge out of computing technology. And that's a interesting possibility. My only question is when, not whether. Whether in person, probably not less than 20 years, maybe 100 years before it happens. But there are all sorts of things leading in that direction that challenge what we think of ourselves as human beings. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be conscious? What does it mean to be intelligent? Probably like artificial intelligence, we'll change the definition as we learn more. We've already changed the definitions based on biology. We found out that chimpanzees and gorillas can use sign language to communicate, and birds are able to use tools. So we've had to redefine a little bit about what it means to be human, because we used to think of ourselves as the animal of language, the animal of tools. Okay, we're not the animal of tools anymore, we're not the animal of language anymore, so now what are we? And we'll have that same type of reconsideration we'll have to do as we go down that path. I was reading recently some of the work on what's called open systems, and in this case, the fact that we have become part of the research. It used to be we could research closed systems. We'd look at it from the outside and be able to analyze it, consider what it does, as if we were not part of it. And the new generational problems we're facing, whether it's at the quantum mechanics level or at this massive level of dealing with large amounts of data and pervasive computing, we're now inside the system. The observer affects the system in the area of quantum mechanics, and the observer is part of the observed in the area of large-scale data systems. So we're no longer outside, we're inside, and the systems we're dealing with are no longer bounded. Can't isolate it out and say, well, let's look at how data mining is going to work in the economics world and then pretend it doesn't impact medical care and other areas, because it does. It just, these things are spanning across all the boundaries in ways you didn't anticipate. One trend I would like to see, I'm a little optimistic on this, is more forward-looking thinking, a field I call predictive fiction, variation on science fiction, where people look at what the possibilities are, start writing fictional stories because they're still writing about the future, about how that might impact society. And then us and the broader public sense of us starting to look at that and say, okay, how does that, you know, now that we've thought about that, now that we see that that possibility is there, is that good? Is that something we want to encourage? Is that something we want to accelerate? Is that something we want to change the direction on a bit? We're going to find more and more we're going to be surprised by technology. And some of the surprises are not going to be good surprises. So looking forward is going to become an essential part of both policy making and just building public awareness and opinion. Unfortunately, we can also see that turning into resistance or an effort on the part of some segments of the public to stop technology from moving forward. It's easy to envision, for reasons of either privacy or other types of belief systems, that people may resist investment in technology, and that's not particularly well informed. If people are not saying, okay, what does that do, and what does that mean, and what's good, and what's bad, and what do we do with it, rather than, oh my goodness, no, stop all that thinking. Don't think about those things. And there's a tendency to do that in some areas, even in the United States, certainly, and other countries, I think, as well. So those will be challenges we face in terms of our looking forward into the future.
What are your top recommended resources?
In terms of what people should be looking at and researching?
Yeah, and you know, we have this large audience of technology and business professionals, and you've covered a number of topic areas and challenged the audience in terms of ideas and ways they can do things. Where can they go for more resources, more information?
Well, of course, one obvious place is the professional societies. That would be disingenuous if I didn't point people off to the digital libraries that are being built and the depth of resource there. But that takes you deeper. That's the vertical bar of the T I mentioned earlier. For expanding your perception of what's going on, there are places like TED, TED.com, that are invaluable. TED stands for Technology Engineering, Technology Entertainment and Design. And there are little 20-minute clips of videos that are available for free on the Internet by leading people in those various areas. It's delightful to go in and watch somebody, talking about how, next-generation computing works and what that's going to do. But you also get in there and they have people talking about what biology is doing or what is happening in entertainment or what music, seeing things happening in music that you didn't think could happen with music, to put it bluntly. And it puts the diversity of perspective in front of you. That's wonderful, and in very short windows of time. So I would look both of those directions. Go depth, go into the into the digital libraries, into the professional research. Monitor what's happening at the edges, and then look at places like TED to get a breadth of knowledge to see what's happening elsewhere. What's happening in healthcare? What's happening in, entertainment? It's very hard because all of these areas are exploding. So you need to be prepared to surf along the top edge of it and get a sense for the breadth of things that are actually going on.
You know, you're referencing TED, and I recall this past year there was a talk by Temple Grandin, and I thought it was just fascinating, because it really speaks to this idea of dimensions of diversity and even cross-boundary spanning.
People who aren't aware of it, I don't know if people on the line are going to be aware of who Temple is, but she's autistic. She has very limited interpersonal relations. But the flip side is she understands how animals are seeing things. So she can provide a perspective on how to build animal care facilities that you wouldn't get otherwise, because she just has a focus. It's different. Brings a different view to the table.
And in fact, she even says that corporations should look at diversity because it brings different viewpoints, which can be very valuable in looking at innovating. You know, Jim, you span a lot of different, regions and domains in your work. You've done really literally everything. So you must come across some stories that are really interesting that you could share with us.
Well, they're you run into all sorts of interesting people. Certainly one person I've run into, and I've run into in more than one context, is Vint Cerf, who's one of the founders of the Internet, which is a delightful factor in his background, currently working at Google. And I had the opportunity to interact with him on a discussion on what's called bit rot recently. It's become his cause celeb or whatever. He's very concerned, and I can understand why. Where's information going to be in 1,000 years? You know, we have all this stuff that we put together, but are people 1,000 years from now going to be able to read it? He gave an example of going into a major library, I think even the Library of Congress, and talking a little bit about information. One of the librarians brought up a book and gave it to him and said, you know, and the book was published in 1300. So here's this, you know, very old manuscript. He said, you can still read this. You know, this is stuff we're producing today, stuff we're going to be able to read. You have to think about that. You know, use the stuff on my iPod or my laptop or in our cloud computing database is something we're going to actually be able to use in 1,000 years. And if not, what does it mean? Are we end up in some form of dark ages because we've lost the ability to retrieve the information we need that is there if we can only find it? The serendipity of this industry, of industry in general, is fascinating as well. I'll pick on something that literally happened to me this week. I'm in a meeting, back to being in a professional society, so here I'm in a meeting, has no technical content. And a fellow I'm sitting with at breakfast happens to be involved in consumer electronics group of IEEE. And so he's sitting there. We have the publisher who's involved with publishing some of the IEEE journals on the other side of the table, and myself. And they're sitting there saying, well, how do we do this stuff for mobile devices? And all of a sudden, we're sitting around the table realizing that consumer electronics folks know what mobile devices are. They're concerned with the manufacture of those, the effective production of them. Our publisher over here is concerned with taking papers and delivering them, and, of course, next-generation multimedia stuff, and how do we deliver that to these devices? And my background in standards, I'm sitting here saying, you know, we should be driving standards in this area in order to make that happen. And I hope we actually get that off the ground and make it roll. But just in that meeting, now that we, the three of us sort of had this building idea at the breakfast table, you know, are out there talking to our friends, emailing stuff around, and building up a community of people who are interested in going out and solve that problem. So that's something that's sort of popping out of the woodwork as a result of these kind of activities in real time.
I was just thinking of your story about Vint Cerf and the concerns about, you know, having that data that's readable, you know, 1,000 years from now. I'm just thinking of 2012, because we're going to have a Solar Max. And what's that going to do to the communication systems out there and access to data? So
that's true. The Solar Max, serendipity. One of my great frustrations as a Computer Society president this year is I was invited to actually watch the from Cape Kennedy, the launch of the SOHO 2 satellite, which went off in February. It went off the week of our meetings, the Computer Society meetings I had to chair. And the reason I was invited is because the lady who was previously a member of our Board of Governors and a good friend I developed through a variety of relationships, her husband's the principal investigator on that particular project, and gotten to know them, so I had the invitation back. Unfortunately, I couldn't go to the launch, which would have been really fun. But the Solar Max is going to occur. The question is, where do the flares go? Do they go to there are many directions a flare can take off from the sun, but if it heads towards us, you know, we need to really duck quick, and it's hard to get a planet to duck quick.
Yeah, some interesting thoughts there. Now, I'm sure that the audience would just love to hear your thoughts about your life experience, but sum it up in terms of career tips for the ICT professional. You know, because you've been out there, you in essence, you had this sort of impact of an order magnitude of $100 billion just from your POSIP work. But there's so much more. So, you know, what's going to make an ICT professional successful? What are your tips?
Well, the first thing is anticipate change in your career. It sounds like a strange phrase. I mentioned I changed careers 3 times. I actually started in operating systems development, ended up in product management, and then ended up in standards management, which is really quite a different kind of thing. And my perception is, and my understanding from everybody I talk to, is that today's graduates are going to end up changing careers as much as 10 times during their lives. So, and the only way you can be prepared to change careers, and that's not just saying, okay, I'm working for company A, I'm working now going to work for company B, or I'm working on a project in this area, I'm now going to work on a project in that area, but literally moving from being a job, you know, that you hired into and expect to be in a job that's building on similar skills, but probably in a quite, you know, quite different job title, one you might not have imagined. Could be sales or marketing or education or something else. But then the second part of that is you're going to be in a job 10 years from now, quite likely, that doesn't exist today. So if you anticipate the fact that you will be in a different career, in a job whose job title isn't defined because you're going to be doing something in a field that isn't defined, I'll give you something that's on an example of something that's on the edge of that. Right now, one of the job titles I ran into recently is a search engine optimizer, a person whose job it is to figure out how to optimize information for search engines. It doesn't take any research to figure out that that job didn't exist 10 years ago because the problem didn't exist 10 years ago. Well, 10 years from now, I anticipate we'll see footprint optimizers, people whose concern it is to figure out what the footprint of technology is, the carbon footprint, the energy footprint, all these different elements, and how do you optimize a product, a device, a method of a problem solution so that it has the minimum footprint. So that's a job one can anticipate may occur. And as an individual, you have to say, okay, what interests me? And keep your peripheral vision in focus, which is to say, watch what's happening on the side. The tendency, I think, and particularly for technical professionals, is to go heads down on a certain area. I'm a Java programmer, or I do, you know, network administration. And so you learn how to do it. You learn how to do it with Cisco. You learn how to do it with this or that. And you get a very strong focus and very deep focus. And you need some of that. But you also need to keep your eyes to the edge because something else is happening out there. And where you're going to be, where you're going to want to help people go in the future is on the edge. It's not dead center. So that's the real challenge, I think, for all of us is going to be to keep our eyes averted from the focal point at times so that we can actually see what else is going on. If I translated that into a corporate environment, the company that's going to put you out of business is not competing with you. And that may sound strange, but look back at history, the transportation world, for example, a classic one we use in the U.S., the people who ran the trains didn't think of themselves as being transportation, they thought of themselves as running trains. They still do. I find it extremely frustrating. If you go to take a train someplace in the United States, you go to a place to say, you go to their website and they say, would you like to take the Capital Express or the Starliner? Why would I want to take a specific train with a specific name? I want to go from this city to that city. it turns out the Capital Express is a train that runs in California through Sacramento, which is the capital of California. But you might think it would go through Washington, D.C., which is the capital of the United States. But that industry has never really gotten with the idea that they're in transportation, not just running railroads. And as professionals, we need to watch for what that other activity is. Somebody's going to come out with a technology that's just going to run right by us. You know, it could be a storage technology, it could be a display technology, it could be something else. And all of a sudden, what you were doing before, what your employer was doing before, is now out of date, no longer relevant. And I watch Microsoft. It's fascinating. I have all sorts of pros and cons I can think of about Microsoft, but their response to cloud computing, which has the potential for destroying their business because you no longer need to buy copies of software, they're out there in the cloud somewhere, is they're making cloud computers. They're they're actually in the business of delivering cloud computing technology to people. So they've figured out where that's going to potentially impact them, line themselves up to do it. And it's that kind of thinking that is necessary to stay on top of the of a field for any period of time.
That's interesting you mentioned cloud computing. In fact, I just finished interviewing the past general manager for high-performance computing, but now is the partner director for all of this sort of cloud technical performance computing area. And he was talking about how you can have sort of all this enormous capacity available no matter what the platform is, or no matter what the device is because of cloud computing. So I'm really now fascinated in terms of your ideas about computing as a recognized profession like medicine and law, and you know, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, recognized credentials. I know that the IEEECS is an innovator in this area. So what are your thoughts about this whole idea of computing as a recognized profession?
It's basically overdue. Part of the problem is our field is very complex. A little like medicine, we have general practitioners and we have specialists, and we span a very wide range of areas, from the equivalents of nursing or lab people all the way up to neurosurgeons. So we need to understand our professions ourselves to be able to articulate that diversity of jobs that we offer and roles that we play. Some areas of computing are in the process of gaining certifications and licensing, and I think that's an essential step. One is software engineering, which is emerging as a licensable field in the United States. In the U.S. context, what that means is there are areas where once we start licensing software engineers, certain jobs of software development will require that you be a licensed software engineer, or that a licensed software engineer sign off on or take responsibility for the results of the work. I mentioned the ubiquity of computing earlier and the concerns of, you know, my local pizza parlor no longer having a viable point-of-sale system for a couple of minutes affects their ability to take orders and deliver. Well, if the pizza parlor has a couple of minutes or hours of frustration, that's one thing. But when airlines can no longer run on schedule, it becomes a more serious problem. And needless to say, if airlines crash as a result of software, and there's some indication that software can certainly have that kind of impact, people are going to get really concerned about the quality of software. And that's where these concepts of professionalism and licensure and certification come into play. And you look at the vast majority of software activities, most of it won't require that level of attention. Probably the code of ethics, yes. Code of ethics where you say, look, you know, when you see a job you can't do, tell people you can't do it. If your job's running late, tell people it's running late. Understand your limitations and use your professional expertise so that the jobs get done correctly and the people involved know that it's happening. That applies almost everywhere. But, you know, the actual obligation to make sure it is done correctly, which is where the certified professional or the licensed professional is held responsible, is also very important. We don't teach that in university for the most part. A lot of university projects, you get by with something that does the job. A simple example out of the April 2010 issue of Computer Magazine, there's an article in there about a lawsuit that occurred with respect to this particular professional ethics issue, where corporations were held responsible for what might have previously been viewed as professional ethics for individuals. But the example that I heard from one of the authors of that article was in just simply translating data from database A to database B and pulling the data out, looking at it, and saying, is this, you know, the query that they had was, is the person male? They said, you know, is gender equal M? If gender is equal M, then set equal male. Now, the next clause is very important and very critical in the software engineering terms and very revealing in that term. The wrong thing to say next is else set equal female, because there's no assurance that the field you were looking at only had two values in it, or that the values in it were recorded correctly. So, you know, good software engineering, yes, you know, gender field equals M, then male, yes. If gender field equals F, then female, yes. It turns out there are other legitimate values for that field, depending on what culture you're in, and the field may not have a value that's valid at all. And you need to detect that if you're going to translate the data correctly. So, in university, we usually don't teach people to think through those kind of decisions carefully and be aware of the diversity and the error situations you encounter. And that's where professionalism comes into play, knowing what the boundaries are, approaching problems with respect to making sure every situation is covered, not just the obvious ones. And we need to get there. And we're going there fully. You know, I think different areas of our field, like software engineering, are going to get there in the next decade. And it'll probably be a while longer before web design and some of the other fields come onto line as well.
Well, Jim, we're near the end, I should say, of this interview, and I'm sort of turning the tables now in that I've asked a lot of questions. Now I'm going to ask you, what questions did I miss? In other words, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
I guess one thing that we didn't touch on that strikes me as being highly relevant is the whole area of what I might call green computing or sustainable computing. The computing field is looking at the pervasiveness I mentioned before, but it overlaps with the environment in significant ways. And young people are very concerned, as I'm pleased to see they're very concerned, with the environment and where it's going. And we need, again, as professionals, to both make sure we're building things with minimum environmental impact and articulating that to the public so the public can be informed as to whether the devices they make are high impact or low impact, the devices they purchase, then also be aware of the fact that our field is making those decisions and support our engagement in environmentally sound, sustainable technology. That touches policy, it touches public awareness, as well as our own professional ethics, as it were. So that's one thing I think we may not have discussed as much as we should have. Drawing young people into the field is essential, and we have the wrong perceptions permeating, at least in North America and somewhat in Europe, of what our field does. In fact, I'm not sure a lot of kids in the United States know what an engineer is or what an information technologist is, and why that may be a very attractive area to go into, and certainly an area they should be aware of. We impact the quality of life, we impact the environment, we impact the things that people carry around with them in their hands, we impact the way they do business, we impact what the future occupations are. And I don't think today's youth knows or understands, even has the vaguest idea of how that plays out. One way to phrase that is, I watched my granddaughter, the Harry Potter movies, and, of course, there are wizards out there, and they're working magic. And we are the wizards. The information technologists, the engineers are the wizards. We're the people who work the magic. Arthur C. Clarke at one point said sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. That's because the technologists are the people who are actually the magicians. That's where the magic really occurs. So I think those are our opportunities and challenges, which we hopefully will take place or take advantage of and deliver some really magical results over the next couple of decades.
Well, Jim, that takes us to the end of the interview, and we really do appreciate you taking the time. I know your schedule is very, very tight, and yet you were able to share this, your experiences, your wisdom with the audience, and we will continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions. You already have a huge history in terms of what you've done, but it's continuing. And again, I thank you for coming in to share your insights with our audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been fun, and I'll look forward to interacting with some of the folks that are perhaps connected here.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Jim Isaac, president of the IEEE CS, renowned innovator, leader, researcher, and educator.